2 weeks ago, we published two observations on Bitcoin authored by co-CIO Ray Dalio and Director of Investment Research Rebecca Patterson. We did so with the recognition that Bitcoin was an asset that deserved commentary and, of course, was getting a lot of attention in the marketplace, and probably rightfully so. Indeed, Ray called it, quote, one hell of an invention. Given the attention our research received, we thought it made sense to continue fleshing out our thoughts. And so today, I sit down with Rebecca to further explore our research on Bitcoin, with particular attention on its role as a potential storehold of wealth for institutional investors. Rebecca, welcome.
Thank you, Jim.
I want to start by asking you to put Bitcoin in the context of the current environment. You know, this is an asset that's been around now for about a decade. So why this sort of increased level of attention now?
Jim, I think the big reason we're talking about Bitcoin now has nothing to do with Bitcoin itself. It has a lot to do with the environment we're in. So especially in developed markets, policymakers are doing everything they can to generate growth and inflation. And as part of that, they're making cash and cash-like assets increasingly unattractive. We're now looking at nearly 30% of the world's investment-grade debt with negative yields. But even there, we're not done. Many central banks are continuing to print money and depreciate their currencies, and all this money printing is needed and being used to fund big fiscal packages. And those packages, in turn, could push up inflation. That means the risk of even further depreciation for the value of cash. So negative real returns. So all of this is pushing investors to seek out new storeholds of wealth. And that raises the question, does Bitcoin have a role here? And certainly it shares some characteristics we associate with traditional storeholds of wealth like gold, but it also has other qualities that make it less suitable, especially for institutional investors.
So let's explore that a little bit more because I think we should start with what should investors look for in a storehold of wealth? And then we can answer the question whether Bitcoin fits into that framework.
Sure. So a storehold of wealth, I'm sure we could come up with different definitions. The way I think about it is that a storehold of wealth is something that's going to maintain its purchasing power over time. And just to make that more plain English, I think most of us associate storeholds of wealth with stability, so relatively low volatility, and a good diversifier. With gold, I think there's three things that really make it stand out as a storehold of wealth. First, of course, is its very limited supply. So in contrast to currencies, there aren't any central banks that can devalue it. And so for that reason, gold, I think, has historically done quite well, especially if we have high and rising inflation. And it's also served as a pretty consistent, although not perfect, diversifier. In addition to that, though, I think gold is easy to transport and exchange, especially in today's digital age. You've got gold-backed ETFs. You can buy and sell allocated or unallocated gold with a click of a button through an investment bank or a broker. And then I think third, but also importantly, gold has such a deep history as something of value. You know, I was looking into this before our podcast just to make sure I had it right. The recorded use of gold coins dates back to before the second millennium BC. And it's like you have to just take a second to wrap your head around that. I think we can agree it's a very unique track record, and that also makes it attractive to a lot of investors.
How does Bitcoin shape up as a storehold of wealth as compared to gold?
Yeah, I think Bitcoin certainly shares some qualities that would be similar to gold and an attractive storehold of wealth. Definitely on the supply front. So Bitcoin has hard-coded 21 million coins. That's all they can ever make. And the issuance rate, so the supply growth, if you will, halves every few years. So supply growth is going to get smaller and smaller over time. Bitcoin also is very easily accessible and portable and exchangeable. I think one could argue even more so than gold because it's completely digital. But there's another point that maybe not everyone knows listening today. You can buy Bitcoin and cash out of Bitcoin nearly anywhere in the world today. You have more than 80 countries that have at least one Bitcoin ATM, and many have decent-sized ATM networks. So you physically can get in and out of it pretty easily and pretty globally, in addition to just through digital networks. So I'd say those are the positives. But then if we want to look on the other side of this, and we wrote about this in our research note and our observations, Bitcoin has characteristics still that I think prevent it from truly being seen and used as a storehold of wealth, again, especially by institutional clients. We'd expect these qualities will probably slow its acceptance among institutional investors. Beyond the fact that it's only existed for a bit over a decade, you mentioned that earlier, Jim, we can't be sure going forward if it's going to be a good diversifier and or an inflation hedge. We just don't know enough history about it to be confident and predict that those patterns will continue going forward. In addition to that, there's a couple other questions I think we have to ask. Anyone who watches Bitcoin knows how volatile it is. Since inception, its volatility against the dollar has been more than 10 times that of major developed currencies. For now, anyway, Bitcoin is largely used in a retail capacity and for speculation. Now, this can absolutely change over time. If it gets greater acceptance, liquidity will increase, and that'll likely help pull down volatility. But we don't know if that's going to be the path. The other thing I would question is regulation, which is still evolving very, very quickly and is very different country by country. The third and final thing I'd say here, Jim, is that the infrastructure around Bitcoin is still pretty immature. You know, liquidity has improved quite a lot since the last bull run in 2017, but the liquidity, which is tied to the volatility, it's still pretty limited with other assets if you compare them. You know, you're pretty constrained in terms of the size of trades you can do with Bitcoin today.
You mentioned the regulatory picture, and I think that's one area where there's a great amount of uncertainty and lots of questions as to what's going to happen. Can you give us an overview of Bitcoin's current regulatory situation and then talk a little bit about the different ways that you think that could evolve?
There just isn't much regulation out there yet. So one of the challenges and one of the reasons for this is that cryptocurrencies have a lot of different functions. Some act more like currencies, some act more like commodities, some frankly are more like securities. So you can't even have one set of regulations for the space. Each digital currency has to be separately considered. There's also the fact that the crypto market is changing so quickly that regulators are really hard pressed, even when they're trying very hard to do this, to stay current, to get up the curve and understand what regulation really makes sense, not just for now, but for the years ahead. So it's not surprising to me that the regulatory backdrop is still in question, up in the air. I think it's going to take a while to get there. But Jim, I think the regulatory backdrop as it stands right now, the main concerns policies are trying to address with regulation is the tie from Bitcoin to potential use for illicit activities, things like money laundering or terrorist finance. And we got comments just in the last few weeks from both Treasury Secretary Yellen and ECB President Lagarde mentioning these specific worries and the need for regulation.
So, Rebecca, that's where we are right now. How do you think the regulatory situation will evolve from here?
Yeah, in terms of regulatory paths, with everything we know so far, we conclude that there are one of two paths that seem more likely. The first path is more draconian. It would suggest a clamping down on Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies. And I think that could stem from a fear among policymakers that these private digital currencies could undermine traditional fiat currencies and maybe also undermine monetary policy itself. And I think China is a great example of this. So back in 2017, China banned initial coin offerings. Those are that's how the process that cryptocurrencies raise funds. And not surprisingly, China's been on the forefront of designing a sovereign digital currency, right? So it's making it harder to own and harder to transact in private digital currencies. And it's trying to get the community, the population to embrace a government-controlled digital currency. In fact, it's already rolled out pilot programs. Households will get the ease of their digital currency, but the government has the benefit of keeping control. So that's one path, and it's happening in China. I think it's highly unlikely in the United States, although I would never say never. The path instead that we think is more likely to evolve, especially in the US, is a slowly evolving regulatory environment that I think at the end of the day, ultimately, is going to engender more trust in the asset. And this would be great news for Bitcoin long-term. The risk I see with this path is more in the process of going from today to the future state. The tighter regulation, in my view, would probably make original holders of Bitcoin who are there for the anonymity and the lack of regulation, they might look for new pastures. And that could trigger some selling and some volatility for some period of time.
I want to go a little bit deeper on a few of the other aspects of Bitcoin that you mentioned earlier that are especially relevant to institutional investors. You know, when I think about gold, it's largely been a good portfolio diversifier over time. So when we're thinking about Bitcoin, what have we seen so far in terms of its diversification qualities to portfolios?
Yeah, we really wanted to dig into that question, Jim, to put ourselves in our clients' shoes and investors' shoes. If I'm running a portfolio and I'm adding Bitcoin to it, what am I getting? You know, it's definitely a challenging thing to answer with confidence since Bitcoin has only been in existence for a little over a decade. So the history we have, you know, we can look at the results, but it doesn't guarantee what we've seen in the past carries on into the future. But for what it's worth, what we have seen so far is that the correlation between Bitcoin and gold or Bitcoin and inflation expectations, as an example, has been mixed, frankly. We haven't seen Bitcoin acting as a consistent hedge against inflation yet. Doesn't mean it can't happen in the future. And frankly, as we get lower and lower supply growth in Bitcoin, it may, but we haven't seen it to a point that makes us feel super confident about it. And then in terms of, okay, I have a portfolio, I want a storehold of wealth that's going to help me get through drawdown. So if my 60-40 portfolio has a drawdown, is Bitcoin going to be the thing that helps offset those losses? When we think about drawdowns, obviously it's going to depend to a degree on what's causing the drawdown. But more often than not, gold has successfully worked to provide that diversification and help your portfolio through those periods. Bitcoin, again, shorter history, it's worked some of the time, but there have been at least two or three instances where Bitcoin prices fell along with your stock bond portfolio. So again, I think the jury's still out. It could evolve to become a great diversifier, but the evidence so far falls short.
Another thing that's important to institutional investors is, of course, liquidity. So in your research on Bitcoin, what kind of liquidity are we looking at? Is Bitcoin going to be attractive to these big pools of capital that want to move in size?
While Bitcoin is becoming comparable to some of the markets that we trade here at Bridgewater, overall, it remains very small, despite its liquidity today being near an all-time high. We took a look at different markets below. And just to give you some specifics, for investors who can trade Bitcoin directly, the capacity today is close to about 10% of the size of the tradable gold market. Bitcoin is even smaller in terms of just real market capacity, what kind of trade you could do. It's about half the size of the iron ore market. And we know that's a pretty small market. So for retail investors, fine. For large institutional investors, you're going to be, at least for now, it certainly could change. It probably will change. But for now, you're going to be very limited in terms of the size of a position you could easily put on and get out of.
So when I think about what you're saying, Rebecca, for all the reasons you've described, Bitcoin doesn't currently look like a viable storehold of wealth for institutional investors. It's more like buying an option on a potential future where these issues are fixed in some way and Bitcoin does become something closer to a digital gold. So I'd like to explore that possibility for a second. You know, what's the best case for Bitcoin if these issues do get resolved and it does see wide institutional adoption?
Yeah, I totally agree with the description on Bitcoin today looking more like an option on a storehold of wealth rather than something that's already a sure thing. But I think it is a great exercise to explore the best case scenario. I just want to say up front, though, that all of us want to be humble about this sort of question, because you could come up with so many different scenarios and they would have different price implications. But we did run in our observations that we published recently a very simple exercise just to give a little bit of context around this. So we wanted to think about what could happen if investors move some portion of their gold to Bitcoin, if they diversified the storehold of wealth asset class. What if they see them as equally attractive storeholds of wealth? And instead of having 100% gold and zero Bitcoin, what if it's 20%, 40%, 50%? We wanted to run that exercise. So we held the current market caps of both things steady and we combined them. So you have one pool of capital. And if we say we have that pool of capital and you're going to have 20% Bitcoin, 80% gold, what does that do to the price? Well, the first row on this exhibit shows you that the price of Bitcoin in that scenario would only go up about 10%, basically because that's kind of where we are now. If you put those pools of capital together, about 20% of it is already dedicated to Bitcoin. But let's take that further. What if we go down to the bottom row of this table and you see 50%? So now if we take those combined market caps, half is in Bitcoin, half is in gold, that could imply a price increase of Bitcoin of about 160%. Now, the reality would be a lot more complicated than this exercise and probably suggests our number is conservative, that the Bitcoin price could go higher. For example, there would probably in this case be some sort of supply squeeze and reflexivity that could push Bitcoin prices much higher. And again, we didn't include central banks here. If we thought that there could be a movement from central banks to diversify from just gold to gold and Bitcoin, obviously that could move the price quite a lot more. But it still gives you a sense, Jim. If we do get to this new world and you do get more institutional participation, you do get this shift to have Bitcoin as part of that basket, you could see prices increase by the hundreds of percent, which sounds like a lot, except we know last year that's what happened also.
One piece of the value of Bitcoin that you mentioned is the limited supply. And Bitcoin itself does have a limited supply. But at the same time, there are all these cryptocurrency competitors that theoretically compete with Bitcoin for investor dollars. So my question is the supply of cryptocurrency as a whole actually constrained or not?
So you're right, Jim. There's thousands of cryptocurrencies today, and they can be very different. As we said before, that's part of the challenge for regulators. You know, Bitcoin is mainly used for transactions. For instance, Ether is used for a platform, Ethereum, that facilitates smart contracts and helps people launch apps, smart applications. So to the degree these currencies are not fungible, I would say Bitcoin supply is limited. The bigger question I'd ask on this front, though, is whether we could see a new cryptocurrency coming online that displaces Bitcoin. You know, if we think back over history of fiat currencies, you have seen reserve currencies rise and fall. We've written about that a lot. So just thinking about how the dollar displaced sterling, could we see something even better displacing Bitcoin? And so that's another kind of supply angle and evolutionary angle about this innovative space that I think one would have to consider if they were going to make an investment there.
One of the things you've written about in a previous Daily Observations are countries issuing their own digital currencies. And some governments and central banks have increasingly talked about this. How should investors think about those currencies as compared to Bitcoin?
Well, central bank digital currencies, they're often called CBDCs. They're not a new innovation like Bitcoin. Instead, they're really just a digital manifestation of existing currencies, right? Call it cash for a modern age. You could have a digital dollar, a digital Japanese yen, a digital euro. Those digital currencies, aside from being electronic instead of something you touch, are going to have all the same attributes as the underlying currency. And that means when we're thinking about storeholds of wealth, if you think the central bank is going to keep printing money, if you think you're going to have negative real yields, the risk to that storehold of wealth is the same, whether it's a traditional piece of paper that you hold in your hand or if it's digital. So that's just an important caveat when you're thinking about these sovereign digital currencies. It doesn't change that aspect of them. Now, I mentioned earlier, some countries already have digital sovereign currencies. My favorite, by the way, is in the Bahamas. Their CBDC is called the Sand Dollar. I think that's awesome. But more and more central banks are getting in the game, researching, testing digital currencies. In fact, there was a report, Jim, last year by the Bank for International Settlements that showed more than 80% of central banks today are engaged in some sort of CBDC work. And that's up from about 65% 2 years ago. So this is moving quickly. It's becoming something that every central bank's looking at. And I would be pretty confident that some of this interest is being spurred by the advancements in things like Bitcoin, right? They are worried that some form of cryptocurrency could displace their currency and undermine the effectiveness of domestic monetary policy.
One obvious way that Bitcoin is different than gold is, as you mentioned, it's digital. But that also opens up potential risks, and I want to ask you about them. You can't hack gold, at least I'm not aware that you can. And there's always this worry that Bitcoin, that there could be a technical flaw somewhere that will allow double spending or something of that nature. And we see these cyber risks in general just mushrooming. So how should we think about that risk?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And it's another reason, and on top of everything I mentioned, that institutional investors may move slowly in this space. Again, Bitcoin has been around for just over a decade. We have seen a lot of hacking attempts. We have seen denial of service hacks. Some of them have been successful, not on Bitcoin. This is a really important distinction, but on exchanges. So Bitcoin itself, we think the risk that it gets hacked is actually pretty small. The community of investors in Bitcoin are incentivized to make sure the code is resilient and is fixed if anything comes up. And so that makes it safe. Its strength, because of its resilience, actually is one of its problems to be used in other ways, right? It's one of the slower blockchains, and it doesn't work terribly well so far as a payment system. The flip side of that, of course, is that it seems pretty safe from hacking. But again, that's Bitcoin itself. But you still have to have a means to get in and out of Bitcoin. And that's usually the exchanges. That's where we see the hacks. So there have been a number of them. I think the biggest one to date has been called Mt. Gox. $450 million of Bitcoin was stolen. I think that's going to be a big problem for a lot of investors. Now, the other risk, which I think is smaller, although it can add up, is just coin loss. And that's literally people forgetting their passwords to their wallets. But those would be the two risks I would be focused on in terms of the cyber one being the exchanges. Bitcoin itself, you know, again, it's not zero, but in our view, it's probably pretty low.
Well, great. I know, like you, I'm learning daily on this new asset class. So, Rebecca, thank you so much for your time. And I'm sure we'll talk more about this in the future.
I'm sure we will too. And my team and I are having a great time digging into this. And as we uncover more and have more insights, obviously we'll keep sharing them. Thanks so much, Jim.